Hey, good, Dean.
I'm doing fine. Yourself?
Good. You have a good weekend up there with the garlic fest?
Very busy. Good. Everything went extremely well.
Yeah.
They had some.
The weather held off pretty good for you, too. Yeah.
A little chilly, but no rain.
Yeah.
No rain did well.
I'd like to call the special meeting of Ways and Means to Order. We're here for a... Well, let me get a motion to...
I'll make a motion.
Second.
I'll second it.
All right. So we're going to have a presentation on the new ISIT policy. You're going to use the screen?
I can.
Yeah.
I'm ready. I have my laptop. Is there an HDMI connector? That's why I also brought the printout of the presentation.
Which would folks prefer? Presentation on the screen. I think that
might policy, and that's the presentation.
Yeah, I think if we can share it on the screen.
If you can share it on the screen, I don't mind having it.
This has the ability to do wirelessly.
Yeah, I'll take a hard copy too.
Okay. I've never used.
Mark, how did you do
that one?
You did that before.
I think that was Amber. I don't know.
It's not a Mondo board though,
and that much. Not a Mondo board.
For what?
Bluetooth? No?
I've never used this particular one, so I don't know.
Oh, there is an HDMI cable that's like 1,000 feet long.
Sorry about that. Thank you.
All right. Great. Thank you. Should we not ready?
Natalie, could we get that email to us with the drawing process? Thank you.
I can really make a couple of
okay, thank
on
you.
On button?
Oh, sorry.
On the left.
I have a...
Warmer. You're welcome. And we don't really need this. Not much on it.
No.
Different.
I don't think it's still up there.
It should be white.
It's already done.
No, that's been done for a couple weeks now. Yeah.
No, I don't see it there.
Yeah, no, that's good. It's done. It's in here.
Sorry.
Yeah, go right ahead.
So I really just wanted to kind of put some things into context, and the purpose of the presentation is to do just that. So just to bring it to everyone's attention, the top five most recent cybersecurity attacks were pretty significant. The one, if you might be familiar with, is Suffolk County ransomware attack. Again, that was an attack that was really targeting people as the vector, and it's 20, well, when this live was created, it was 22 days and counting. It's now 25 days that Suffolk County has been down. Their public safety system was offline for quite a bit of time. They brought their financial system back up. They're still operating in, I don't know the percentage and where it stands, but there's still a large portion of their operations are still offline. Due to this ransomware attack. NATO, they had some sensitive documents stolen off their network and is being sold on the dark web. Uber got a social engineering campaign, really had to penetrate the defenses by engineering attacks against users, either by the phone or email or other kind of capabilities, and got into their administrative credentials and gained access to their system. Cisco, major corporate network, they compromised an employee's credentials because that person stored some of their credentials out on the Google Drive, and they were able to sort of backdoor into the Cisco network. And then the Costa Rican government had a ransomware attack as a service, and these are sort of dark web kind of players out on the internet that do ransomware as a service. And there was a multi-agency ransomware attack that was a national emergency. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention. This is something that just came to my attention just yesterday, was the Los Angeles County, or Los Angeles School District, is now suffering from a ransomware attack. The ransomware players have actually gotten that data. It's out on the web. Los Angeles is not going to pay the ransom, so the data is being sold. And it's ongoing right now. And I wanted to kind of, if I could just sit next to you so I could see the slide. Well, I have it in front of me, but I want to kind of articulate like the three main kind of legs of a really good IT policy and a posture. It really relates around people, process, and technology. So the people, both from end users and actual technical people, they're kind of like the a really significant component of a really robust IT security capability. Really under having proper training, understanding the risks that are out there, understanding good best practices for password management, how you handle data, how do you identify data, really elevating people's suspicion about the different types of communications that need to come through their email, text messaging, voice, etc. It's really important to kind of elevate people's awareness because they're the single most impacted target in an organization. And professionals also need to have specialized skills, both people who are directly engaged in IT and people who are adjacent to that, either could be a subject matter expert in a particular system or a particular service that might be attached to a department, or it could be a vendor that's providing some support. So those all require specialized handling, both from skills and also how we provide access to those systems so that we can either grant or remove access accordingly and really have some robust procedures around that. You know, process is a big thing. Process really, when you look at the new NIST is the kind of the standard. The National Institutes of Standards and Technology really helped develop key operating standards that an IT organization, either be a commercial entity, a private entity, not-for-profit, school, et cetera, they should use certain procedures and techniques to develop a good and develop and manage and refine their processes, both from from training to granting and identifying how you grant access to certain systems, how you approve those access, how you remove the access when that's no longer needed. How do you articulate the need for change in a system so that you're not inadvertently exposing a system to a risk or inadvertently opening up some kind of capability that wasn't there before? And how do you escalate and triage an event in case something were to happen? How do you build these processes around it so you have a really good operating environment? And bake that into a standard operating procedure, not just from an IT perspective, but from the county perspective. Like, how do you develop robust incident management around a cyber attack, for example? So those processes are really important to identify and have them solid. And the technology, obviously, is crucial. And the technology, as we all know, has changed significantly in the last 23 years, which is when the last IT security policy was developed. You know, it's a comprehensive mix of technologies that need to be deployed and upgraded and assessed in a regular on a regular basis. Everything from next generation firewalls, network segmentation, how you partition off networks from, say, the public safety system versus DSS, and the financial system from the public safety system. Those are all things that we need to pay attention to and deploy technology to kind of get us there. Authentication and password management is really important so that you know that you're rolling passwords in a regular manner, that you're expiring them in a regular manner, and that you make it easy for people to do that, right? And make it so that it's not cumbersome, so that you can kind of create this ecosystem that makes it really easy to support cybersecurity. Intrusion detection and prevention is another piece that we have services. In fact, I'll get to them in another slide, that allow us to really monitor the traffic coming in our intranet and from the internet and on our intranet, so that we can detect whether or not we have suspicious payloads, emails, events that are happening on the network, and not just detect, but also get alerted to these events and then to be able to respond accordingly. Security and intrusion, security and event incident management, which is kind of related to intrusion detection, that if some suspicious activity is happening on our network, files are being moved from one location to another, or passwords are being fat-fingered over a certain length of time, we know that something suspicious is happening, and we can get alerts and monitor, and we can sort of triage that event accordingly. Endpoint detection is big as far as, you know, are our laptops, mobile devices, et cetera, being have antivirus on them, and not just antivirus, but that there's also some technology that can then detect whether or not that payload is part of a known payload out there on the internet, and sort of identify signatures and things so that we can actually react, shut that down, triage it accordingly, that our data is encrypted properly on our network as well as off the network. If you go out into the internet, that is being protected. The data is being encrypted in transit. That's a security component. And also our data is encrypted at rest whenever we can. So that if someone were to backdoor in that and they would access the data, they wouldn't be able to see it because it's encrypted. And backups and recoveries are also really important so that if something were to happen, either a legitimate outage, if it's a power outage that we can restore, or if it's a ransomware that we can restore to a clean backup. I want to just quickly go over the NIST framework. This is something that is all IT organizations that are sort of have adopted. Well, first of all, this is a standard that's been developed by the National Institutes of Standards and Technology. And it's a framework that all IT organizations can use to build a really robust cybersecurity capability. I won't get into too much details, but our security policy is based on this framework. The last slide I want to show you is from 2017 until today and into 2023. These are all the technologies, the training for our people, the process improvements that we've developed over the last 5 or 6 years to really harden our environment, and a lot of this, all of this that required funding was thankfully funded by you all, but we've made some significant progresses in since 2017 till now, and we continue to kind of develop some capabilities. We have just recently, we're going through a NIST assessment by one of our vendors, Sodero, looking at our processes, what we have to date, the technologies that we have deployed, and they're coming out with a gap analysis. We're doing quite well. We have some procedural things that we need to tighten up. They're going to help us develop some of the procedural gaps that we have. We recently did a FEMA tabletop exercise with the Department of Emergency Services, which is really important. It was a national exercise that we did with many players from across the country. Very revealing, very interesting. I came away feeling quite good about our capabilities. We still have some gaps, as I've mentioned, but we're getting there. And again, the main reason why we're here is we're talking about the IT security policy. But moving forward in 2023, We are working with Sodero to develop a cybersecurity, a virtual chief information security office, which really kind of gives us some capabilities that we just don't have. We just don't, and we couldn't really afford it, where they bring together a whole team of people that have cybersecurity expertise. They're constantly being trained in new technologies, new procedures. They act as our escalation point so that if an incident were to happen, we could bring them in. They could help us engage with the right entities. If we have to reach out to Department of Homeland Security or the FBI, they're partners with us in this space. And that we're going to kick off in 2023 so that we can actually, they kind of augment our team. We are planning on, we're in the initial phase of onboarding onto the New York State Joint Security Operations Center with their an endpoint protection and remediation system, which is really comprehensive, and I look forward to that. We actually had it planned for in our budget, but this came out recently from the governor's office, so we're going to jump on that. I just wanted to set the context for our discussion today. Mm. That is it.
I had a question. You can take some questions now or no?
Sure, yeah.
All right, so on the Sodero assessment, so that does like an end-to-end assessment of, from the moment somebody hits a keystroke to it goes to the cloud or wherever it ends up?
So it's not a penetration test.
It's not a penetration
test. No, that is something that I could put that on. That is part of our 2023 assessment. Is that we have to engage with Department of Homeland Security,
yeah,
and CISA, They have a free service of that, but getting the queue is
probably a long list.
But we plan on that, but that's not what that is, right? Okay. It's more of like what they look at our processes, they look at our documentation, we kind of give them an inventory of the systems that we have in place, our various technology they have in place, and they make some recommendations on that. And they've also given us, out of the assessment, they've given us some frameworks and document frameworks for disaster recovery, continuity of operations, and so on.
Thanks.
Thank you, and thank you for submitting this update and for the presentation. In 2019, as you know, we had the legislature hired Eisner Ampner to do an assessment due to an internal conflict. And a part of that assessment, they did an IT policy review. Did you cross-reference that all of their concerns in that review are contained in the new draft document? Like, did that review at all inform this document? Because I haven't gotten into the nitty-gritty. That's my next step.
Yeah, so there were some aspects of that. I think I have some notes on that. Let me just figure what I think. I did review some of that. So some of it is... training related. So we have we do roll out regular yearly training for our staff, mm-hmm. and also refreshers at the end of the year. We onboard new people with cybersecurity training, and we also on a yearly basis, at least a yearly basis, if not twice a year, we do a phishing campaign, and out of that we can assess who needs more help. And we target them, and in fact, we just finished this phishing campaign this morning, and out of that, we had, out of 1,296 recipients, we had 79 people that clicked. So it's a 7.7%, I think, 7.7% click rate, which means...
Not good.
Well, the last time we did it was 14 and change.
So you did really good, but still right. not good.
Still yeah. not good, right? So
where do you think? What do you think that is? Is it education? Is it, you know, constant? You know, because I work at IBM, yeah. and we get hammered with those.
Yeah.
They send one, you know, to different people, and you know, I can sit here doing the same job. He'll get it. I won't. And 3 days later, you know, Dean will get it, a different one, and they look, you know, they are convincing as heck, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that definitely we need to do more of this. We should yeah. probably do that more frequently.
But you hear the frequency. How often are you currently doing it?
About once a year.
Oh. Yeah, that's something I think you know, yeah. my opinion, anyway, you know.
If I could just, so, but the executive summary from that study, training was one component, but there was there were many recommendations. Now, granted, one of the things that they were looking at was the policy from whatever it was, 1999, like the policy that's currently in place, the forever ago
right,
policy.
Right, 1683.
Exactly. So I get that there's no doubt that many of these things have been addressed. There was no email retention policy. There was no hardware disposition policy, all those kinds of things. But I just, did you actually... like confirm that everything in that policy was addressed, and one of the big ones that jumped out was security breach procedures. The whole I don't know how in depth this policy goes in terms of breach containment, breach resolution, and roles and responsibilities, none of which existed before
right.
this.
So the way I look at the security policy is really sort of a relatively fixed document. And the procedures behind the scenes support what we do to kind of fill in those gaps. So, for instance, like our breach, a procedure for handling a breach should be flexible or fluid so that when things change, we can adapt accordingly. So that's where Sedera comes in, where they, as part of our engagement with them, is to develop those types of procedures, a formal procedure, so how we can escalate. Also working with the Department of Emergency Services and their incident command structure training about how we are supposed to contain an event. So these are formal trainings that we, as my department, are participating in. So that with that internal training and with support from Sedera and their virtual CISO program, we want to fill in those gaps, procedures on how to develop escalation policies so that if we had a cyber breach, who do we reach out to? Department of Homeland Security, FBI, et cetera, et cetera. So that's part of our...
But are you suggesting that even the framework of breach policies and procedures not be contained in the policy? They're contained somewhere else in what you're calling procedures?
Right.
You know, I mean, I'd have to, and I will, I'm going to reread these recommendations and I'm going to cross-reference them to all this detail because this is substantial, but it concerns me having things not contained. I want the policy to be living enough that you can adjust, but also to contain the bones of what's necessary for everyone to be on the same page. You know, breach infrastructure is something that not just a few people need to know, like the hierarchy of how we deal with the breach across the whole across the whole organization.
You know, so I think there's a distinct difference between policy and process. That's something that I think is really important, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the policy says these are the things that we're going to do to prevent it, and then the process is a result of this, and this. And you don't necessarily document every single process in your policy. See what I'm saying? So I can almost understand why, you know, a breach process wouldn't be part of the policy. Because the other part of that is you really don't want to publish that, right? You know, you don't want to put that out there, what your process is going to be to recover from a breach, because that just gives them another, you know, step ahead of you.
Right.
You know?
Well, I think you're sort of both right. The policy is the what. The procedure is the how.
Right.
And they need to be combined together, though, because, and this is always the tricky part of a policy and a procedure, is does it pass the bus test? And if you don't know what the bus test is, for those who don't, is if somebody who in your procedure was listed to do something or to be involved in something, and they got hit by a bus, is that mission critical, or is the whole thing going to fail because of they was too strict? You also don't want it too loose either, where you have people having to make decisions on the fly, and you may not have the right people in the room at the time. So it's a balancing act, and I do a lot with policy and procedures, so I'm familiar with where you can go very wrong with being too strict, but also go very wrong being too loose either, as well. I understand what Chair Bartels is saying. We need to, it's sort of, they're interconnected. Policy and procedures, they're really...
There's no question.
Yeah, they're really connected to each other, but you it's a balancing act.
But again, just to be clear, I'm this is not my expertise, clearly.
Yeah.
I'm referencing the Eisner-Ampner that we hired in relation to this, who had specific recommendations, and their language is that we should have this in the policy. I mean, that's their, again, I'm looking at it right now.
I agree, and I don't think I've heard the answer yet. So has that been looked at when developing this, or at any point compared to it? Because I know Chairman.
So there is an incident response section of the document. It basically highlights what we will do if there's an incident.
That's not the question.
It doesn't tell us how we're going to do it, because again,
the question again is the recommendations from what
here was Eisner Ampner. It was the IT policy review from January 30th, 2019.
So which I'm looking at.
So you haven't looked at that when developing this. So we don't know if it actually addresses all of the recommendations. It may very well do so, but we don't know that for sure.
Well, so for instance, like the backup recovery and replication procedures, I don't see that necessarily as having to be part of the policy. We have operating procedures on what we do to back up, when we back them up. Some certain systems get backed up at different frequencies, and say 3 or 4 years from now those systems go away, we don't need that documentation anymore, right? We backed it up differently. Or say 5 years ago we were backing things up to tape. We don't do tape backups for most systems now. We do them for only certain systems. So the actual mechanics under the hood are going to change. The procedures under the hood are going to change. But the thing that we need to identify is that we are going to do backups on critical systems. We're going to restore them. We're going to test them. That's that we want to identify. This is what we're going to do. We'll develop procedures behind this that support that are flexible enough to change when the technology and the systems that we're supporting will change.
But again, the question comes into play, the what that's in that report, does it match the what that's in your now new policy?
I think what he was saying is not necessarily. If I could just answer this really quick. I mean, I think we did look at some of the recommendations, and some of them we took. I think Alan needs to take a stronger look and just make sure that anything that makes sense to go in the policy goes in the policy. Obviously, this isn't going to pass this month. But I do think it's important, as a distinction, there are standard operating procedures that don't necessarily go in a policy, but to your point, Chair Bartels, need to be written down and publicized to a larger group than just maybe IS, right? So, I mean, I believe we have that, but those don't necessarily need to go in a policy like this, because they need to be more flexible. They need to be documented, and we can make sure that that happens. But to the question of whether all of the recommendations from IS or Antner are in here, I don't think they are.
That's okay. I mean, I just would respectfully ask that maybe, and I'll do it as well, but that maybe we do cross-reference it again and just make sure.
Yep.
And I hear your point. I mean, but I do think it's important that they are actually somewhere in. I mean, if they're recommending policies and procedures, that it may be, you could tell me that it's not in this policy, but it needs to be a policy somewhere that's real and actionable and across the organization that people are using to prepare.
Or we can document why we didn't follow the recommendations. Recommendations.
Yeah, that's fine too.
They are an accounting firm. They
have also 3 years old.
They have forensic experience.
That's a world of difference.
3 years
we
ago.
We may not have taken every single recommendation.
Ransomware was like just coming out 3 years ago, you know?
Well, it would make it even all the more important in some ways.
So if I may, I wanted to ask two questions. One, I just want to go back to the phishing thing. So the seven people that clicked, what were they met with?
79
people, 7%. 79 people that clicked. What were they met with? When
they get
clicked?
Sent to a, you have inadvertently clicked on a, and they it goes to a web page on our training platform, KnowBefore, and then they go through some training material. So they get immediately sent to a splash page telling them what they did wrong, and then some training material that sort of helps to kind of reinforce. And remind them that they need to, be more vigilant, right? And
I will not
give
click
some
on
training.
Links.
I'm just going to keep going on this for a second. I would suggest if they have this as a feature that they also be met with, that there actually be a second stage, and that they're met with a data capture field that continues the phishing guise and sees if they enter the email. Because clicking is one thing, and it's bad. Entering email is another thing. It's very, very bad.
Well, it does. You click in the email is one thing. You open the attachment is another flag, and 12 people actually clicked on the attachment. Out of 79 people that opened the email.
Well, we don't know who of the 79 people. You know, you'd imagine that the funnel of people who would actually enter their credentials in, because their free UPS package is waiting for them to put their password in. That would be a small subset of highly risky users.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's a feature, I would suggest exploring that, because I completely agree that the center of all of this is the human, the phishing training is such a huge. It's probably like the single biggest thing. Once you get everything that you can do, it's the single biggest thing outside of your office that can save everybody. And which brings me to my next point, which is I'm looking at the data owner responsibility section of the draft, and it seems to leave discretion up to the data owner outside the IT department, but like the in department, the other department data owners.
What page?
This is page 23. It seems to leave discretion up to them whether or not they verify that the users are doing the trainings that they need to do. So I would just say I don't think that we can leave it up to anyone's discretion to have an auditable log of who's done what trainings. I mean, this specifically says data owners may choose to require the authorized user signature to acknowledge this notification. And I think that that's, you know, culturally we need to instill a redundant auditable log of everyone who's getting trainings, and it should not be left up to anyone's discretion. Discretion on data security should exist in your office and your office alone.
Right. Well, when a person does their security training, they sign off and we get those forms and they're inputted into OnBase. So we know who has gotten the training, both on an onboarding training and the yearly review.
So is this not accurate then?
What page is that again?
23255.
That's a good one.
That is referencing collection, retention, and classification of electronic data.
Yes.
Right.
Arguably the most important part of this policy, which is, you know, the classified data and how it's treated.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it's really just those three words, may choose to, rather than will.
Yeah.
Well, I think owners of confidential or sensitive data, right? So who determines the owners, right? That's one thing. Is it the department head who's the owner of that data?
But I think it's the next sentence that Abe pointed out.
Oh, no, I agree with Brian as well. But yes, I am pointing out that there's a question of, let's say we know who the owner of the data is, or who the owner of the decision of the classification, right, to classify something as sensitive or confidential or internal or public. And then that person who is going to allow their reports to have access to classified or sensitive information, you know, those people, like, there, I would imagine, and I think that this policy is intended to reflect escalating levels of responsibility as the sensitive nature of the data you're accessing escalates, right? So those that have access to confidential information would have the most training. And so for department heads, say, that are the data owner, right, because those are the records at DSS that include people's social security numbers, right, as an example, that department head would, according to the sentence that I'm reading, would have discretion as to whether they choose to require the authorized users, right, their direct reports, to acknowledge this notification. Now, I don't know if this notification refers to the you know, giving them this policy or what it is, but I assume that the notification that we're talking about here is one that would tell them how to treat that data and really give them a sense of how grave it is that their email address is one that can log into county systems and have a permission level that would allow them access to that data. That person becomes a much higher risk. And so that's, you know, just making sure that we're super buttoned up on that those people are treated appropriately, given the right resources, the right training, and that we have an auditable log to ensure that that's all happening, I think is really, really important.
Well, we do, just for clarification, we do have an auditable log. So we have a system called Baronis, which we put in, I forget what year we put it in, but it essentially is monitoring our file systems for various kinds of content, be it financial data, social security information, bank routing information, HIPAA types of information, PII information, and it's a monitoring system that flags when that data is detected. It also...
But that's not what he's asking. He's talking about this. So this is more about the training, it sounds like, what you're referring to here is the
training.
Yeah, acknowledging the training by signature or not. It seems to be up to the discretion of the data, which, again, who is the data owner? I don't really know that either. But it's whether or not you require a signature, or you just hand them a training and say, here, now read this, and you've been trained. I guess to Legislator Ushel's point is it needs to be documented that they received the training, they read it over, they reviewed it. If they had questions, they were asked and answered, and they accept what's written into the policy and the training. It's not so much about your ability to see who accessed things after that. Well, at that point, unfortunately, the horse out of the barn and we're in trouble because it means we're playing catch-up now with a breach.
So can I ask another question? I'm going to take it at a higher level, right? So do you have systemic, like, cryptography involved in this data, like, you know, prior? Because, like, I'll just talk for what I know. You know, we have programs that encrypt it coming out, going out, and encrypt it coming back in, right? So everything that's out there is encrypted, right? Do we have anything similar to that, and do you see that happening? Because here's why. You know, if you have that, you know, then the data owner doesn't have to worry, right, if they're, you know, taking care of the confidential information, because once it leaves their keyboard, right? It's encrypted, right?
Right. So the short answer is yes.
Okay.
So with like Office 365, yeah. our main sort of, our collaboration platform, the transmission of data is encrypted end to end. The storage out on Office 365 is encrypted in our tenant. So the data at rest is encrypted. The data in transit is encrypted. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, kind right. of. Like, so right. folks that, like, so with my little, what do you call these things?
iPad? No.
Surface.
Surface. Right, so any data that I have on here, right, I can get off here if it's confidential, correct? And so that's like where my concern is.
Right. So right? I mean, so it could exfiltrate from your computer somehow. Right?
Somehow. Right. Right. Yeah. And so, you know, again, I know what I know. IBM turns their USB ports off.
Yeah.
You know, you can't use them.
That's actually my question too. Is do we have USB lockout here at the counter?
Not yet.
Okay. Yeah. So I'm used to it at the hospital.
Yeah. Right.
Not yet.
So you plug in a thumb drive, the alarm.
When you want
off.
To get serious, right? You know, and I we used to have, you know, going back, we had two levels of encryption. One is if you had PI, one if you didn't, right? So if you want to store PI on there, you better do this next level of encryption, right? But now they say, forget it, I don't even care. Everybody's right. going full bore out, right?
It is on our roadmap, but yeah. not yet.
But I guess to Kale's also point, and this was one of the other areas, I don't remember if I think you said it was Los Angeles, it's not just a matter of, you know, USB drives, it's Google Drive.
So
that's where, yeah. again, this policy falling into place, training on how to properly store and secure information, don't use Google Drive, don't use Yahoo email, don't use right. Google email, Gmail, any of those things. It there should be approved methods of securing data.
Well, perhaps we have, you know, outside of the policy, that we develop a training framework that, besides just general cybersecurity hygiene, there's some data specific handling training for specific types of people.
Department head. Yeah, there's different levels.
Well, whoever this person that owns the confidential data, right? You know, I think there should be some guidelines around that as well. You know, at who is allowed to control that data, right? Because it's really, you know, that's like Abe said, you know, that's the stuff that we have to guard.
And a lot of what this policy kind of puts that out there, and that we, you know, frankly have to elevate our game to get us there, right? Right. As opposed to having a policy that's where we are now, we want a policy that we want to be at, you know, and that we can elevate our game to get us there, right? So some of the things that are called out in the policy that we may not necessarily have the capability yet, we want to get there. But we don't want the policy to catch up to us. We want to catch up to the policy.
I just want to point out that is the opposite of what's happening here. What I'm hearing is that we are collecting signatures of people doing the training, but it doesn't say that in the policy. So that's the opposite of what you just described.
What do you mean?
Well, not to take it off of Legislator Cahill's point, but, you know, we Mark was just saying that we are collecting signatures that people are doing the trainings. It doesn't say that here. So if the policy is what we're aspiring to achieve, what I'm hearing is that the policy says we're not doing it, but we really are doing it.
There's section, it's page A4, which is the Ulster County Employee Agreement, which is essentially what you're agreeing to. You have to sign.
This is the appendix.
In the back, right? So the appendix.
But the point I was making is during our annual training, corporate compliance, which includes data protection, we do require signatures that people have been trained. So you may want to just look at this policy.
But I just want to say, this is what I'm saying. This is why I also asked about the training that people receive. And I'm very happy to hear that the 79 people that clicked received a training immediately. Although I'd rather give them an opportunity to enter a password first. That's why it's so important that in the moment people are reminded of the security posture, right? And so the training that you do annually or whatever it is, like, it's, you know, you're going to come in there to work that day and you know you're going to leave having signed the log to say you did the training, no matter what happens, right? But when you are, you know, being given information, either you're the person who's deciding to classify something, or you're a manager who's deciding to give access to a classified data set, like, the acknowledgement in that moment, like, is so much more impactful on the psychology of the user, the employee, that I think, while it might seem redundant, I think having layers and gates that have a paper trail that are not just the annual compliance, but while I do appreciate that, to have that really part of the workflow around the classification and exchange and access granting actions, right? Around those actions themselves.
So we do have in our ticketing system, like, we have to grant access to certain folders. Those folders are either permitted by department heads, and certain people have access to those folders or granted access to those folders. So those, that access is a chain of command that has to go through an approval process to grant or remove access to that folder. That folder could be on a file server. Traditionally, it's on a file server. So there's a whole approval process, change management process, that grants or removes access to certain types of folders that contain certain types of data. Right? Does that help answer your question?
That. No, I appreciate that. That's definitely part of what I'm talking
about. And so it goes through. It goes through a series. I don't know it off the top of my head, but it goes through, you know, the person who, if it's a it has to get approved by the data owner. In this case, it's typically the department head or the manager of that data is approving it. But it's typically the department head that approves access to certain kinds of folders or the removal of those types of permissions.
So it's to the individual, not the job.
It's to the individual, right?
So a couple questions. I mean, and to stick on this subject for a second then, I mean, and back to Legislator Uchitel's original point on page 23, what would be the circumstance where an owner of confidential or sensitive data, in this case we'd be talking about a department head or a manager of a program, would not require the authorized user's signature? Once again, acknowledging the security of the information, why would they not want? Why do we allow in this policy the flexibility to have the owner say, you know what, you don't have to acknowledge it? Like, I think that is a
I think you strike that quite honestly. I think everybody should sign.
So it's a question, like, why is there a functionality reason why you wouldn't want an owner of information to require acknowledgement of the person that they're giving it to, even as a one-time thing at the start of a program and the sharing of this information?
No.
So maybe that's a good catch, that we would want to change that language. I have two sort of more general questions.
We could potentially include it in our change management system that if a person is requesting access to a folder, we display, you know, some kind of information in the ticketing system, and it's tracked that when that person has been granted access to it or requests access to it and then gets granted access to it, they have this splash page that comes up in our ticketing system that might inform them about some of those rules of engagement.
Yeah, I mean, I just think that the language, if it says that data owners will require the authorized user's signature to acknowledge the notification, and it's up to you to determine at what point in the process, like, that could, again, be the beginning of program, not in each exchange of information, but I just think it does make it stronger. My two sort of general questions, and this obviously is a like, this is going to take us a little bit to really get into. And again, I do want to just say I appreciate that.
I'm glad we're having these discussions. These are all good things.
That we're finally here. But the policy references a bunch of titles at the beginning or at some point here. And what I'm wondering is, do all of these, here we have the Ulster County Information Services, then we have the Information Security Officer, the Architect Review Board, the Chief Information Security Officer, the Officer of Internal Auditor, et cetera, et cetera. Do all of these positions already exist?
No.
Or are we...
They're not necessarily positions, they're kind of functional... roles that are...
Currently doing all of them? Okay, so it's no to the positions currently existing, but is someone currently doing these roles, or again, is this the aspiration we're trying to?
That's the aspiration. Again, this is based on the NIST guidelines, NIST framework. So some of these roles, like, for instance, I'm the Department of, I'm the Director of Information Services. I'm also the Information Security Officer.
Right.
right? Mm-hmm. It's not a title, it's just I happen to inhabit that role, right? Yeah. That role could be assigned to somebody else, right? Just the same thing with the Chief Information Security Officer. We're developing a program with Sedera. They assume this role for us to help escalate incidents, and et cetera. But it's not an actual, it's not a title. It's not a title that's...
Yeah, she's not looking at the question. She's asking the question.
Basically, yeah, what I'm asking, yeah, that's, I mean, I think, and the part of the reason I'm asking is that we're heading into the budget cycle, right? I mean, this is just a fortuitous time to be discussing this. And, you know, there are aspects of a successful information security policy that are going to cost some money. I'm not trying to spend money wildly without it, but I'm just saying we need to know. I think we need to work through this, but we also need to be prepared to spend some money potentially on implementation. And I'm not sure what that's going to look like, but it's starting with the personnel. I appreciate. So, you know, if they're, for example, you just said you're the Chief Information Security Officer. Someone else could inhabit that role. That's fine. But what's important is that everyone in the organization knows who the Chief Information Security Officer is. Everyone in the organization, if we have a Chief Information Security Officer, if we have an Officer of Internal Office of Internal Audit, we all need to know who that is and where it lives. Otherwise, it's not going to function the way that it needs to. And that sort of leads into my next comment/question. As it was pointed out, you know, this, what the legislature undertook with this report, Eisner-Ampner, is now 3 years old. I'm wondering, and I'm not going to get the answer right today because I think it's going to take a little more detailed review and cross-referencing, but would it be valuable to have an outside agency look at this proposed policy? And again, I don't want to hire people unnecessarily, but just to make sure that we're conforming with best practice. I mean, I have to say, I couldn't stay for the whole time, but I did call in to that NISAC, and I saw you there, that NISAC brief on Suffolk County, and it's like we should be, this is not my forte, but to hear what's happening in other organizations and what may or may not be happening here, we should be very concerned.
I wasn't here for that study. What was that based on? Was that same thing? Was that based on NIST assessment at the time? Do you know?
No. It was based on the policy. So the policy that's in front of you.
No. Well, it was based on the policy.
I mean, so.
Can you ask why it happened?
No. I'm saying we had this, and so their assessment was based on what? You know, was it based on current NIST?
The policy that the chairman is referencing.
So they just were just looking at that policy only and make suggesting corrections. But what I'm saying is, what did they use as their basis to make those suggestions?
Well, can I just also say they were looking at this policy has been in draft form, and I'm sure has been changing over the years, but it's been in draft form, not brought to the legislature all this time.
No, I understand.
In 18, there was a draft version of this, mm-hmm. which is the draft, you know, Ulster County Information Services IT Security Policy 2018 version 2. They reviewed that as well. Their comments were off of the earlier draft of what is now this policy, which I imagine has changed substantially, both because of this and because times have changed.
So I understand that. So they compared this and this, but what was their basis for the comparison? In other words, what did they say? This is the gold standard in which these things are being, that I'm looking at and making suggestions for improvement. They had to have something. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they NIST. Didn't.
That's what I'm thinking.
It's got to be because everybody NIST. Uses NIST.
So everybody. That's what I'm they saying.
Yeah, they didn't reference a single gold standard, but they're, I mean, they're, this wasn't their first time doing it. They're experts in
right.
IT
so my
policies.
Point being, right, if we're doing the Sedera study, right, if that's the same criteria that they used, except 3 years newer or 4 years newer by the time it's done, is that accomplishing the same goals? See what I'm saying? I mean, because they're going to be using the new updated policies, correct?
So DARA has that as part of their.
Yeah. So that was just a question. If you knew that, yeah. If you don't know,
no, I don't know offhand what they utilized. I don't.
Because it would seem to me that they have to have something, right, to judge this and this against, to say that this is what I'm basing this need for improvement
on. I would imagine that's proprietary, that they wouldn't want to tell us what, you know, what they use to judge. Otherwise, we would just get that information and do it ourselves. We wouldn't need a consultant.
So, thank you for the opportunity to speak. First of all, I want to say, like, from where I sit in our view of county operations and finances, there really is almost no greater area of risk than this area. So we applaud you in bringing this forward, and we're really happy about it. And I have the 18 policy that you shared with me, I think, when I first started. I know for me as a department head, I want to be notified. If I have an employee who is clicking on a phishing scam, I want to know it. So I think, you know, just obviously sharing that information downstream to people who are managers and supervisors would be excellent. I am greatly concerned that this policy names an internal audit office, and this policy is a virtual mirror of the Fairfax County cybersecurity policy. Cybersecurity policy in Fairfax County also identifies an Office of Internal Audit. They have an internal audit office that is tantamount to the county controller. I spoke to the internal auditor today. Her name is Sharon Prebody, and she is the officer that I identified. It is her office. It is not a separate function of internal audit within IS or IT. So I urge you to really think about that. I'd like to have more conversation about that. Her role, Alan, is limited to audits of and reviews of the way people interact with the system, so it could be collaborative.
Internal affairs, it's, baby.
Yeah. So I do not want to see, and I would not support a separate creation of another internal audit office. And I think we are not called the Office of Internal Audit. We are called the Comptroller's Office. So this policy needs to be updated to correctly reflect who we are. I also want to say Fairfax County is 1.1 million people. They have a county executive and board of supervisors form of government. And there are things in this policy that are too big for our britches to some degree. I think the one on page 23 is something like that. Like, why are we giving department heads the authority to give somebody an out on training, but also the requirement that every department name a DISC, a DISC. I can't remember exactly what the definition is, but it requires having somebody who has network analyst credentials in every single department. We don't have that. So, and it's not even a goal. It can't even be a goal for our county. Like, we are never going to have that level of capability inside, say, the Youth Bureau, right, or some of these other smaller departments. But maybe we just figure out a way to push that responsibility back to IS, which I think would be very wise. So I think there's some places where we have to look at modifying to address the smaller departments. And then there's a section in here on private devices, and we now, especially in the remote environment, have a lot of employees using private devices. When I was here in my previous incarnation, I had two devices, a work device and a personal device. Now I have a single device. I am definitely going to put in a request to move everybody in my team who has to handle email or communications outside of work hours. Now we're going to put in requests for phones, because this policy says that Alan can come in and take everybody's personal device on a moment's notice, which makes sense if there's an investigation happening, but it also means that they are without their personal device, and they, you know, we're going to just have to separate those functions. And then finally, there is a section in 4.3 and in 4.0 in general about data access and active monitoring. And I will just say, the previous Eisner-Antner came out of direct, like, fights between the controller's office and the executive's office. I wasn't here. But I am concerned that if information is absolutely, IS should have the capability of reviewing and monitoring everything that happens. I agree 100%. But to the extent that information going to be shared or disseminated outside of IS, right, then I want to be notified. If you are taking my communications or data on an audit and sharing it to the executive or to the commissioner of finance who is on the steering group, I want to know. I want to know. So I think there are things here for elected officials that are different than regular department heads, and it's not being treated that way. So those are my thoughts in general. I think all of those things can be worked out within this document, within the framework of this document. And I laud that we're moving forward on something comprehensive.
Chair Rittles.
Yeah, thank you. You know, it's funny because, and I appreciate the reference now, I just pulled up Fairfax County. I mean, and that's where you begin. You find a great policy and you model it. There's no harm. But there were things that I had started to underline, like authority, talking about policy authority designated to the county executive, you know, where I've highlighted, where we have a form of government where policy authority is the legislature. And I'm like, why is it, like, why, what is this, a power grab? Like, why is this all going in the executive? But I realize now it's the Fairfax County language. So I do think probably we have to go through to just do that kind of fine-tuned comb, which, because it's so thorough, because it's we're going from a three-page document that talks about, like, faxing protocol to, you know, a real security document, it's going to take a little time to work through. So again, I don't want anything I say to be construed to be, it's all constructive criticism, because I'm very happy that we're doing this. We need this, and again, I can't, like, if anyone wants to watch that, I'm sure NYSOC's probably posting that, but it was a pretty alarming brief.
That's a pretty big county.
Yeah, but again, it's like, I suspect they probably had more security in place than we currently do, right? So it's like,
You don't know.
So we need to, this is a lot of work, and so I thank you for that. But I do think, I think the comptroller's point is well taken. We need to go through and kind of scope for those kinds of things. I mean, your point on the phones, which I didn't even think about, would probably result in nearly every employee wanting a county-issued phone to keep the two things separate. Although I would venture to say, notwithstanding any other national scandals, it's really hard to keep things separate, even if you have two phones. Like, people, there's no way, even if I got a separate phone, which I actually had but handed back, if I had a separate phone that was county phone, there are people who are going to call my other number. Like, you know what I mean? It's just going to happen. So, we're in a very tangled environment now, much more so since COVID, with everyone now working from home environments or being used to working from home environments. So,
We have, I'm assuming, cybersecurity insurance, correct?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. Do we know the policy limits or no?
$100 million. No, I'm just kidding.
Not the top of my head, but we had to employ a number of technologists to even get it. Mm-hmm. We almost didn't get it. We had to employ, I think last year we had multi-factor authentication on our Office 365 and VPN. This year we had to have MF multi-factor on all of our management systems. So all of our ability to manage our firewalls and switches and routers and Active Directory and all those management systems had to be put behind MFA as well. Also, we wouldn't have gotten cyber insurance.
Even if
we had to increase our premiums and our deductibles and lower our limits in order to even be covered this year. Because, and there's a lot of counties that aren't.
Yeah, and why did you have to? Why? What was the
lack of controls?
Is it that what it is?
Yeah. It's a huge risk for the insurance companies.
And yeah.
They're not willing to insure. I mean, there's counties that are struggling. They're going self-insured. They're doing other things. And we were able to convince them to allow us to tweak a couple things. They weren't huge changes, but it was the only way we were going to continue to get insurance.
Did you mention before, you said you had an exercise done? Was that through Homeland Security CISA exercise?
Yes, it was. Okay. FEMA, CISA.
Yeah.
Last Thursday.
Oh, you just had it?
Just had it. Yeah.
Okay, so we don't have the results from that, the findings. No. Okay. Because I've been through that, and it's quite comprehensive, and it's good, because it exposes your vulnerabilities and weaknesses there. We have the ability to do secure emails?
Yes. So you're talking about, like, encrypted emails?
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's built into Office 365. You can enable an encrypted email pretty easily.
So is it also any form of AI into it to where it automatically picks up certain things like social security numbers?
Yes, so that's called data access. I forget the acronym, but it basically scans all emails for things that flags as PII, routing information, bank information, HIPAA. Right now, all it does is it warns the sender that you're sending it. It still sends it, but it warns you that you sent it. We could be more aggressive with that, but right now it just warns, because sometimes it's a false positive. Many times it's a false positive.
Do you know what our ping rate is for outside attacks?
Say it again?
Our ping rate for outside attacks, do you know what it is, what we're talking about today?
I don't have the absolute numbers, but we have, per day we're getting millions of messages per second. Of those millions of messages per second, approximately 90% of them are email attacks.
And I guess to Comptroller Gallagher's point, from where I work, if there's two parts. So if there's a person identified that they clicked on an email and they have to do the training, an email then immediately also goes to the department manager as well as HR, because it goes into their file. If they don't get caught again, I think it's within 18 months. We do ours actually every month, every 4 to 6 weeks. We're doing a phishing exercise for our employees. It's a quite serious thing at a hospital, so we do it quite often. But if they don't get caught again, then the letter goes out of their file. But if it doesn't, then the stupid little training, I mean, I don't know what the county's is like, but the one we get at the hospitals, I mean, it's the most ridiculous 2-minute training that pops up that you've ever seen. I mean, you take the training, you didn't really learn more than you did, but you should have known beforehand by just using a computer nowadays. But I definitely, the department manager should know, as well as human resources. The keeping track of who's accessing information and what information you're sharing with others, what we've done at the hospital is we've got our compliance committee, but then we have the executive compliance committee, which is senior leadership that to deal with situations like this where we have to access, IT had to access somebody's computer for some reason to get information off of it. That doesn't just happen blindly behind the scenes. They have to go to the senior administrative compliance committee, say what they were doing, why they were doing it, what information. Depending on what it is, we may ask for the granular detail of what they pulled off of that person's computer, but usually it's just, was it really warranted for you to go in and do that? So I don't know if that's something the county, we would implement here, but I know it's been pretty valuable because there's been some requests from managers to go onto their employees' computers where really they were just being nosy. It was not really a legitimate reason to pull off information off of that computer. Anybody?
Yeah, I got it. So going forward, I mean, this is a situation that's going to get a lot more active going forward, and we have to have, really vigorous response going forward, right? So how much of the budget that you have in your department, roughly, do you think you should be increasing for this, right, going forward? Because I think, we really have to be cognizant of that. This stuff is not free. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite, right? It's very expensive. And for us to make sure that we're doing this correctly, we really should be, in my opinion, allocating resources, for that.
I'll have to look at the numbers. I have it roughly, I don't have it in front of me right now, but we did do a calculation of how much an increase in our budget was spent on cybersecurity-related services, hardware, software, and so on. So I could provide that. We have that number from at least for the past 2 years, what that increase was. Mm-hmm. One of the reasons why we brought on Sidera is that in order to get that capability, we could not afford it. The cybersecurity training that those folks have, the numbers of people that are involved in it, the security operations center that is where all this information and alerts get funneled into, it's just we couldn't do this ourselves. So the amount of money that we're spending for Sidera really gives us an entire team and a security operations center behind us. Mm-hmm. Same thing with DynTech and our intrusion detection system. Like, we couldn't do this. We couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why, like, in certain circumstances, we leveraged third parties that had been vetted by Board of Elections, for example, or they, and so we do the due diligence in there that the state has vetted these vendors, and we've worked with them to kind of bring them in as partners. Otherwise, we just couldn't afford that capability. So to answer your question, so in some circumstances, it's cheaper. In many circumstances, it's cheaper to go with a vendor. You get more bang for your buck.
Yeah.
And they're going to keep their skill sets up to date, and we're just really responsible for doing the remediation and the sort of the day-to-day operation stuff. Same thing with the Joint Security Operations Center, the JSOC. I mean, that is something that, again, we couldn't do that ourselves. You know, and the value is just enormous. You know, to have all these alerts being rolled up into a dashboard that then the Department of Homeland Security says you have an issue. You know, you should probably go and remediate that.
Yeah, I guess to, you know, expand upon that, but also what Legislator said before, training, we've switched at the hospital instead of doing IT, doing the annual training, and we were doing quarterly for some departments that really involved. We went with a company called Treliant, I'm not sure which way it's pronounced, but they do a lot of our modules now, and it's interactive training. So it's the employee just doesn't sign a policy and says that they read it. No, it goes through, it gives questions, there's little games sometimes in them. So it's interactive, and you can't move on until you've completed it.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's twice a year.
Yeah, we're doing it now for all of ours. Our compliance training is done that way, IT training, and new employee orientation, and there's a few others, cultural sensitivity and things like that, but those are all being done remotely because we've discovered that the time it takes to pull entire departments into a training room, it's just easier to assign them the course. We know they're taking it because it's interactive, and then there's an audit trail because it's on the computer. When they've completed it, there's a thing, goes in their file, it's easy to audit trail.
Yeah, we have a vendor called Novi4, which we use for our phishing test. They also have training modules, which, again, when you get, we could also leverage it as a yearly training platform, and we can investigate that.
Have we had a risk assessment done?
Not recently.
When's the last
one? The last one was done, let's see if I refresh my memory, we had somebody come in from NICETECH. They're a vendor that works with Department of Emergency Services for a variety of different infrastructure needs, and they came in and did a brief risk assessment. They helped do some, they deployed some agents on our servers and did some snooping around our network to see what kinds of vulnerabilities we had. And I have that document, but that was probably 2018.
It was Pat was here, so.
Who was he?
Pat Ryan was executive, so.
So 2018, 20, 19, yeah, somewhere.
20.
Yeah.
I think it was 2020.
Okay. What does a risk assessment cost?
Well, that one was free. Because it was through Department of Homeland Security, right?
Yep.
But we haven't, I don't know.
I mean, would it be helpful to get a risk assessment to inform what actually needs the most attention?
Isn't that what CISA just did?
Sorry?
Isn't that what CISA just did?
No, we did it's a tabletop exercise we did through FEMA and CISA, which is the one, the national event, which I mentioned. So that was a tabletop exercise to really run through some scenarios and to exercise the plans or the lack of plans.
Oh, so they didn't do an analysis of our systems involving vulnerability testing.
No.
Okay, that's what I was referring to. Okay. That's what we've had done at the hospital. And they went into what Chair Bardell's is looking for. They went in and tested. They tried to get in at certain points. They tested employees randomly. They went through, tried to get them to respond to emails. Mm-hmm. They did several things. It took about 2 weeks. And they actually came on site for two of the days of the 2 weeks and were doing stuff there, trying to gain access, physical access into IT closets, mm-hmm. tried to get staff to give password, pretending to be a doctor. I mean, it was a whole crazy thing they were doing, but it was quite comprehensive. And it definitely was.
CISA definitely offers a penetration testing service, which I mentioned is a free service.
Yeah.
Getting into the queue is the biggest challenge.
Yeah, it took us 14 months to get it, right. After we put our names on the list, it took 14
so
months.
So we've expressed an interest to have a penetration test done, and then we wait to see where that leads.
Yeah. All right, nothing else? Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. That was very good. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. And about this, about the phishing campaign. So these are the results, the plan, and then this could be modified. The plan literally just got the results today. So the plan was to send out the list to the department heads and also post the general results on the intranet, so to show what, you know, what our phishing campaign looked like. You know, I'm sure many people were unaware that this was happening. And I applaud many people. Yeah. Many people have called and said they see suspicious activity, and we're like, it's exactly what we want.
Yeah.
And we want you to call us. We want you to report it on the portal. We want you to submit a ticket. We don't want you to act. You want us to reach out to us. So
did more people report it than clicked?
Yes.
That's good.
Yeah. There's good. More tickets that were opened up during this event around suspicious email, suspicious content, than prior to that, right? So those results, again, we want to send the results to the department heads with the folks who were the most vulnerable, and post general results out on the portal. Not to shame people on the portal, but to reach out to the director and let the director shame them.
Tell all employees, there's no missing dog, the neighbors did not lose their dog, they don't need to click on a picture, and there's no suspicious vehicle with a license plate that you have to download the image to. Those don't exist.
I don't get a heads up, and I didn't have to do the training, so I'm happy.
Cool. There you go. All right, can we have a motion to postpone this to next month?
I'll make a motion to postpone until next
month. I'll second it.
Month. Unless it were a month, or do you want to do it sooner?
I think we need a month.
Oh, I think we need at least a month. I mean, I think it's going to
All right, second, Kayleigh-Anna, discussion.
Is there anything that I should be doing between now and then to either shore this up or make some updates to it? Or?
Well, I mean, I think what I would suggest, the comptroller said that she had suggestions, and then maybe all of us present, and we can reach out to our colleagues, like anyone who has specifics, I think we should go through and get them to you.
Uh-huh.
I would say that would be the first. This is a lot for me to wrap my head around.
And also, I think you need to go through again and make things actually relevant to our county versus, you know, where the original policy
is. That, I think, would be helpful, just to try to do a first pass, just to see where there are glaring, where this feels like it doesn't directly apply to Ulster County, mm-hmm. and make changes there in those spots.
And I could also respond to the Eisner-Ampner review, because much of what was in the...
What page are you looking at?
This is number... Page 8, the mostly accomplished. Number of those we have been.
I have a different. I want to make sure. Do you have the final report? Because I don't. Know the final. I mean, my 8 on the final report doesn't look like that.
I have.
I don't think that
October 7th, 2019.
I don't think so.
Are you kidding me?
There were two different ones, I think. There was the policy review, and then there was the security analysis. Forensic investigation.
What's the date on?
This is October 7th, 2019.
Okay, that's not the final report. You're looking at a draft. We can get you the January 30th. It was definitely shared.
January 30th.
It definitely was shared. We were at a meeting. We all discussed it. How could it not be shared?
I think it was still under executive committee.
Sure,
no.
No, not this. No,
who has it?
Anyway.
But there was another document, and it was never...
But we're not talking... But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the IT policy review, which definitely was a part of a public meeting, was discussed in public, and we will get you a copy of this one. Rather than looking at a draft, go from the final. Because this one breaks it out from most urgent. I can say... Many of those things are addressed here, which you'll see quickly.
Okay. Who is sending it to him?
Well, our office.
Okay, so you got it?
Yeah.
Great. Thank
you.
May I have a copy as well, please?
Yes.
Eyes. Okay.
We can send, and we'll make sure everyone agrees in this case. And send it to all of us.
I make a motion.
We already, we got to finish the other one. All those in favor of postponing to next month?
Oh.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Now motion to adjourn.
I make a motion to adjourn.
Second.
Those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you all.
Thank you.